Glenn Johns, welcome to WFMU. You've got this brand new book out called Sound Man, A Life Recording Hits with Rolling Stones, The Who, Led Zeppelin, The Eagles, Eric Clapton, The Faces. And the list really does go on and on and on as we've been listening to some of your music this morning. The first thing, and you bring this up, I think, in the preface to the book, what does a producer do and what should a producer do?
The requirements differ slightly depending on who the artist is and what their needs are. But the basic role, as I see it, is to try and help the artist represent where they're at in their career at that given moment when making an album. I've always worked with songwriters, so it's sort of a more complete package, as it were. He's there to provide support, advice when it's required, with regard to the choice of the material, the manner in which it's performed, the arrangement, the choice of instruments used, all obviously with the approval of the artist. He's responsible for the sound of the record, the running order of the record, the budget, the amount of money spent on it, and that's about it, really, I suppose. Yeah.
And so what were your strengths and your weaknesses as a producer, you think?
I have no weaknesses.
That's the right answer.
Well, of course I have, but I haven't concentrated on them too much, I don't think. I don't know, really. I mean, I think probably the fact that I'm a recording engineer helped tremendously, and a lot of people liked working with me because of the sound I got. And that, obviously, if they know they're going to work with somebody who's going to represent them sonically well, and that won't be a problem, I'm sure it takes a load of pressure off any artist before they even go in. So that's quite helpful.
Yeah.
And also, I suppose, the fact that I've worked with a lot of very well-known artists, some of them slightly more difficult than others, and so therefore got a reputation for being able to do that. And so perhaps on occasion I was sought out because of my previous experiences with people who were well-established.
You're born in 1942, which is the perfect time because of the post-war boom and sort of this really a thing that didn't exist started to exist. When was the first time you heard sort of something like rock and roll music?
Oh, that's a very good question. Well, the first thing I heard that turned my head was Lonnie Donegan's Rock Island Line, which was completely different from anything I'd ever heard. I was probably about 14 years old. It became a huge hit in England. As far as rock and roll was concerned, it was probably, well, a bunch of stuff, Elvis and Fats Domino and, you know, the same sort of stuff that was going on here.
Yeah, so you're 12 years old, which is like the perfect time to have your mind blown by that sort of stuff. So your mother, I think, put you in the church chorus, which you did pretty well at, and that seems to have sort of started you on your way to music, and you started hanging out with what you called the gang, which was really just a bunch of kids hanging around, swapping songs, playing guitars, and that sort of grew into a cover band that you're in called The Presidents. What was the scene like? I mean, it's very, very early days for rock and roll in music. What kind of sets were you playing? Who were you playing to?
Who were we playing to?
Yeah.
Anybody who'd pay money to come and see us, I suppose. A bunch of kids the same age as us. We were playing at sort of venues around London and sometimes in London. And we were just playing, like any other cover band, we were playing whatever was in the hit parade that week. You know. In the top 10.
You were something of sort of an entrepreneur, you know, promoting shows in the back rooms of pubs and stuff. Was that a common thing?
No, not at all. That's a bit of an exaggeration, really. I mean, I did, because our band, there were a large crowd of kids that used to meet all the time, and the band came out of that, and we just decided to take the room in the back of a pub on a fortnightly basis, because for us to play to our friends, really, and that grew to be packed every night we played. The only time I ever tried to book anybody else was the Rolling Stones, which I tried to book in on an alternate Friday before they were known at all. They'd only just formed, and we thought we'd have an R&B night, and that didn't work out. The local people were not ready for the Rolling Stones.
So you lost money promoting the Rolling Stones?
Oh, well, I didn't lose anything. Well, I think we paid. I say in the book, I think I'll go down in the annals of rock and roll history for paying the Rolling Stones the least amount of money. I think we paid them the equivalent of about $1.50, because there were only three people in the room, only three people in the audience.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, so that didn't last long.
So one of the big revelations for the book, something I really didn't know about, was that you did have a singing career, and I think we'll talk a little bit more about it later, but really in your mind at this time was an idea that you might be a professional pop star at some point.
Yes. When I first got a job in a recording studio, up until that moment, it had never entered my mind that I'd have anything to do with the music business as a profession in any shape, way, or form. I'd enjoyed music from a very early age, as a hobby, just like any other kid, and the fact that I was in a semi-pro band, in which I didn't always appear with. In fact, I managed them rather than... I sang with them on occasion. I didn't sing with them all the time. The music business as such was as far removed as the moon to me, and it was a quirk of fate that got me a job in a recording studio, which sounded interesting. And having got the job in the recording studio, I then thought, well, possibly I could use this experience to further my career as a singer if I was to have one, because I'm going to be meeting a lot of very influential people who will be coming through the doors every day, and that's exactly what I set out to do. So, and eventually, after a short period of time, I finagled my way to being discovered by playing some stuff to one of the producers that were coming in, and I got a record deal as a result of that.
Yeah, there's some great records. My favorite, I think, is "Today You're Gone," which I think came free with people bought Westcott jeans and they got a free copy of the record.
That's extraordinary research on your part. I have to tell you, I've completely forgotten about that. How extraordinary!
Oh well, that's a number one hit. That's a fantastic recording.
Good God alive.
You leave school at age 17, you take the exams, you're not sure what you're going to do, and then your sister has a conversation with her boss's friend, and like you said, just a coincidence, you get a job at IBC, which is, as you say, the finest studio, and one of the first sessions you're at is Lonnie Donegan, one of,
first day I started was Lonnie Donegan, and this is the guy that was the first record I ever bought, so... that was pretty astounding. I thought I'd landed on the moon. It was a remarkable experience. And he was Pi Records, which was the label he was signed to, were a regular client at IBC, so all their acts were recorded there. And so I did an engineering, but I was the second on a lot of sessions for Lonnie, in the early days.
It is really like being on the moon. Tell me what the studio protocol was at that time. You say you were the second engineer. It's still time of jackets and ties and lab coats and things like that.
Exactly. The technical guys wore lab coats, and the sound engineers were required to wear a tie, a collar and tie and a jacket. Yeah.
And you sort of, in the book, you have a lot of stories about guys treating the folks lower than them terribly.
Well, the comments are made with me being one of the lower people, so I suppose I was just reporting on my own personal experiences. Maybe I was particularly revolting and needed to be treated like that. But no, there was a hierarchy. There isn't any job, So I don't think there's anything unusual about that, really.
You got to work on a Beatles TV show again, very early days. You make this story in the book about the Motown guys coming to do a TV show, and you're worried, how will you ever get that Motown sound? Yeah. And then it turns out that they just plug in and the sound is there because it's them. Is that a valuable lesson?
Incredibly valuable lesson, yes. Particularly in that period of time, we were all being influenced by what was coming from America and the way it sounded. Everyone's nose was being led by that. So we were English musicians were required to copy the style of American musicians on the pop records that we were making in the very early 60s. And equally, we were supposed, as engineers, supposed to come up with a similar sort of sound. It was very much dictated by what was coming from America. And in a lot of cases, it was quite simple to do. But the Motown thing was very different. And I was astonished by the sound that was coming from them from their technique of playing was clearly what it was all about. That was a massive lesson, yes, absolutely.
I get the feeling from the book that you're a guy who likes to speak his mind, and perhaps that has something to do with your success. You know, as you said earlier, you could handle the big stars, but was it very difficult when you were a second engineer to keep a lid on things?
No, I was in most cases, not all, but quite respectful to the people around me, and I knew my place. In those days, from the education that I'd had and from the way I was brought up, I was taught to be polite, and on the one hand, and on the other hand, I realized that the only way I was going to figure anything out, having walked in off the street knowing absolutely nothing about what I was getting into, was to keep my head down, do my job as best as possible, keep my mouth shut, sit in the corner, and look and learn. Which is what I did. And it wasn't difficult to do at all, no.
So how long from, you know, making tea to being a first engineer?
Being senior engineer in the studio was probably 3 years. To get my hands on the console was probably 18 months.
No, that's not bad at all, really. And a typical week, I mean, it seems one of the great things about this job at IBC was you were doing classical music or jazz or jingles or, you know, Lonnie Donegan. It could vary so much. And these were three-hour sessions, four times a day or three times a day?
Exactly. It was the best education anybody could have had because of the variety, not only of music but of personalities, just about everything and anything. We do music for the series Wagon Train for CBS Television America. We do movie music, we do jingles, we do classical music, we do popular music, we do jazz bands, we do absolutely anything. Jingles in particular were interesting because of the speed with which the economy factor came into. And in a three-hour session with a jingle writer, you'd probably do four or five jingles. So you had to be on your toes. It was good from the point of view of learning expediency, basically.
So this is the very early 60s, and you sort of have this new guard of guys like you and this old guard of guys who had zero experience or maybe even appreciation for rock and roll music. So was there like a weird new guard, old guard tension thing?
I think, kind of. It wasn't too unpleasant. It was just the older guys that didn't get it and dismissed what was going on as nonsense and nothing they identified with, rather like me now with what's going on now. There's very little difference here. And us kids were lapping it up, and the louder it got, when the Who and the Kinks started coming in and we were recording them, or people like them, and the rules, every rule in the book was being broken, and you know, it was frowned on tremendously by the manager of the studio even. So, but because it proved fairly quickly that we were winning because we were having immense amount of success with what we were doing, the competition faded into the background, as it were.
So one of the big breaks is that they let you go in on Sundays and record who you like. And it seems like you got to really just, you know, start experimenting at that point.
Yeah, well, that was sort of before the period I was just talking about. Yes, in the first year or 18 months I was working at the studio, the only way you would ever get any experience literally by doing a session would be being allowed to use the studio when it wasn't being used by anyone else. And it was never used in those days. In the weekends, it was unheard of. So I started a regular Sunday session, and the word went round that there's this guy, you can get free studio time if you're prepared to put up with an incompetent engineer. and it was quite fun, actually, really interesting. I used to take mostly friends in, and it was just an opportunity to get your hands on the gear and try and figure out actually really how to work it, you know.
Yeah. I believe your roommate during this time is Ian Stewart, sort of the Rolling Stones' keyboard player, road manager, you know.
Well, Ian Stewart, I'd met in my teens, and he'd become a very dear friend. In fact, I think by this time we probably started to live together. Oh, not yet. We didn't do that until we were about 21. We lived in a house together for a while before we both got married. He actually put the Rolling Stones together with Brian Jones. It was he and Brian that put the band together in the first place. And so therefore I had seen the band right at the very beginning because I was a friend of Stu's. And I then suggested, having seen them play, that they might like to come in and we record something and we could see if we could get him a record deal.
You painted a nice picture of him as just a great guy.
Oh, remarkable man. I miss him dearly. He's the best friend I'll ever have, without any question. Unfortunately, he's deceased. He died quite young, and he was exactly the same man the day I met him as the day he died. He never altered in any shape, or form. He was a really unusual guy, dearly loved by the Rolling Stone, by the other members of the band, hugely respected, an extraordinary musician. I mean, the best white blues piano player ever, in my opinion. And a real, he's somebody who really never held back. I mean, he spoke his mind. Was singularly unimpressed by fame or celebrity. Not in an unpleasant way, but it never affected him in any way whatsoever. And that's why they loved him.
So in the early days, you're engineering, you know, it's just the pace throughout the whole book, the pace of your life is really unbelievable. You know, it's all of the early Stones records. It's the Kinks, All Day and the Night. It's the Who, My Generation. It's early Bowie. It's Small Faces. It's the Easy Beats, Friday on My Mind. It's Del Shannon. It's The Move. I mean, it's unbelievable. But there's also all these, you know, but I think because it was the era of the 45, not the album, you know, people would come in, you know, and record a single and you might never hear from them again. But, you know, bands like Sean Buckley and the Breadcrumb or the Factotums or the Rocking Vickers and, you know, John Lee's Groundhog, you know, all these bands, you know, that recorded just a few singles, but they all do sort of...
There is a discography in the back of the book, which I got someone else to do.
Yeah, well, it's not nearly complete. I mean...
No, it's nothing like complete. And the reason for that is, I'm amazed you managed to find out as much as you did. I mean, first of all, it was a long time before engineers ever got a credit on anything. And I don't remember every session I did. Of course I don't. I've got a bloody clue. I can barely remember where I live. A huge amount of what I did isn't recorded. No one knows, and that's fine. But I think it does state on the discography that it isn't complete, and if it doesn't, it should.
Yeah, well, at some point it'd be lovely to put together a full thing. One of the first things I see with your name on as producer is the Fleur de Lis Circles, which is just a powerful record, and it really is kind of a template of what a lot of your records will sort of sound like in the next few years. I love that record.
Well, that's interesting. I'd forgotten all about that one, too, but I do remember them. They were a very good band, actually.
And you break into producing, it seems like, through Steve Miller, sort of. Is that right?
No, not sort of. Absolutely, yeah. In those days, engineers did not become producers. They were a completely separate job. Totally separate. When I first started, producers weren't even called producers. They were called A&R men. And they work for a record company, as A&R men do now, but their job was far more complete. They actually signed the artist, and they were responsible for the repertoire of the artist, hence A&R, artist and repertoire. And they would then, having signed the artist, they would then be responsible for their recording career by actually producing the records that they made as well. So in the late 50s, early 60s, there wasn't any such thing as an independent record producer either. So by the time, I'm sort of early 60s sometime, independent, some of these guys left their jobs for the labels that they worked for, realizing that having had success with popular music, they could easily be in demand as an individual. They didn't need the job with one company anymore, so they moved on. However, engineers they were a breed apart, and the two things never crossed. I was working with Steve Miller. I'd worked with a lot of producers in the 60s who'd become regular clients. Steve Miller had signed a deal with Capitol Records in America to make his first album and had decided to come to England. His manager rang me. I think it was something to do with the fact that I'd been engineering all the Stones records for some time, and said that he wanted, would I be interested in doing Steve Miller, because it was a blues band. And I said, yeah, sure, okay. So I took the job as an engineer. And when they arrived, I realized they didn't actually have a producer. Well, Steve Miller was probably calling himself a producer. So we had 6 weeks to make the record. And after a month, they hadn't really achieved anything very much with Steve experimenting and fiddling around. So I sat him down and I said, look, I'm finished. I can't do this anymore. There's nothing happening. We're clearly not going to make a record. This project isn't going anywhere. And I've got better things to do. So he said, well, what's the problem? I said, well, there isn't a producer. He said, well, will you produce it? So I said, sure, okay, all right. So we actually made the first album in the next 2 weeks. And that was my first official being retained as the producer. To be fair, I suppose I had contributed to the production of records over the years prior to that. I was quite happy not to be paid for that or to be recognised for it even. It didn't bother me in the least, because as far as I was concerned, I was getting great experience with some really talented people. And I took that experience with me on when I did wear the hat, as it were.
It seems like having an incredible amount of patience is really one of the most important things.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And it's in normal everyday life, I have very little, if any at all. I think I've used it all up in the studio. Yes, you're absolutely right. You do need an enormous amount of patience.
So now you're producing all kinds of folks. If we Google your name, the number one thing that comes up is this way of putting microphones on a drum set. That seems to be, like, on your tombstone, there's going to be a diagram of these microphones around the drum set. You know?
And it'll almost certainly be incorrect.
Right. And that's
because all the examples on YouTube are nonsense. Well, I mean, they're people, I don't know where they get the idea from, but they don't know me and they've never seen me do what I do, so I don't really understand it.
But the basic idea is you use sometimes only three mics instead of 100 on the drum set, and you get a very simple, kind of very open, big sound that way, and it's been imitated and incorrectly reported on quite a bit.
Completely correct. Everything you just said. Totally accurate.
And you say in the book that you've never used a measuring tape. That's another thing. People think
why on earth would you do that? That's absurd. Yes, of course not. No, you use your common sense is what you do. It's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. Leave people alone. They'll imagine anything and then write about it. Yeah.
When you record, do you record with compression and things to tape, or is that something during the mixing?
So my general premise is to do everything as I'm recording. And then, obviously, one might alter things fractionally in the mix. But the idea is to get the overall sound as you're going. It's far better for the artist to be able to come in and have a playback of what you're doing where it's sounding very, very close to what it's going to end up being. Gives them a much better picture of how successful they're being, really.
Yeah. How's your hearing? Is it good? And does it? Do you have to listen? What volume do you listen to in the studio when you're listening to a playback?
What was that? I listen very loud because I like it, and my hearing's very good still. Actually, yeah.
Tell me, how does a producer get paid? And have record companies been honorable to honor those agreements with you?
They get paid. How do they get paid? They get paid a royalty. They get paid an advance against a royalty to do the project in the first place. And then once that advance has been recouped by sales, they then get paid a royalty, which is negotiable before you start the project. And as to whether people have been honorable or not, there are a couple of companies that I've worked for that I would never ever dream for a split second that I would never dream of challenging any royalty statement. But there are many others that I would, if I had a substantial sales, I would without any question challenge what they're sending me, and you can almost be certain to find fault to their benefit. Do you know what? I don't lose any sleep over it. It is what it is. I've got a roof over my head and food on the table. My children are all fit and well, and I've made a very good living doing something that I absolutely love doing. So I'm an extremely fortunate man.
Yeah, we're talking to Glyn Johns, and he's got this new book called Sound Men. You're listening to WFMU, and it's Michael Shelley here. Like I said, I really, really love the book. It's just, you know, it's a fascinating page-turner. It's kind of divided up into chapters that sort of tell a little story and shed some light on things. One of the amazing things, I mentioned this earlier about the book, is the incredible pace. You would go from, you know, session to session to session, sometimes in the same day, and you'd be mastering, you'd be mixing, you'd be recording, you'd be flying to L.A. and back. How did you deal with this?
I asked myself the same question when I sat down to write a book, because living through it, I didn't really take that much notice of it. When I researched to do the book, I kept diaries from 62 to 82, sort of thing, that were all related to my work. So it was all listed out, and which had all been in a box in the attic. And I got them out and looked it up, and thought, Christ, how the hell did I do that? How am I still alive? It's quite extraordinary. No, it's amazing. I was exhausted just reading the diaries.
You were so busy, I assume you had choices to make and turning down some jobs. You just couldn't take them all. Did you ever turn down something you really regretted or not get to work with somebody you wanted to?
No, I don't think so. I think I was pretty fortunate there. There probably was several, but I can't recall them offhand. Nothing that broke my heart. The fact of the matter is that obviously one's time is limited, and it wasn't like I was wasting my time doing something else to the detriment of something I'd really like to have done. I can't think of anything offhand, to be honest. That anything I turned down, I invariably turned down because I didn't want to do it.
Yeah, it seems like you felt very comfortable working in Los Angeles, like almost that was a second home to you working for a while. Why such a good feeling about Los Angeles?
I think most British people, because of the climate, really, really like California. That'll do for a start. But of course, there was a scene there which I identified with from the minute I landed there. And it was very different. There was a music scene there that I really identified with. And I was very comfortable there. In fact, I still am. I have more friends in L.A. than I do in England.
You tell some good stories in the book about Led Zeppelin. You recorded the first album, and people didn't get it. In fact, you went out of your way to get folks to listen to the record.
The story I tell is about George Harrison and Mick Jagger, two people I was working with at the time in parallel to doing the Led Zeppelin stuff. I don't think it's true that a lot of other people didn't get it. The story is about those two individuals, and I specifically played it for them because I thought I was excited and I wanted to share it with George on the way home one night. And I took him to Olympic and played it to him, and he didn't get it at all, which is fine, you know. It was just a shock, really, because I thought we all were influenced by the same stuff and seemed to me to be have pretty much the same taste. Of course, that doesn't. Strictly true with anything, really. But equally, on the other hand, with Mick Jagger, we were putting together the Rock and Roll Circus program that they were, TV program. We were having production meetings for that and trying to decide who else would be on the bill. So I thought this would be fantastic. It would be a huge coup to have Led Zeppelin on, whom no one had ever heard of, because I suspected they were going to be enormous. And Mick didn't get it at all either. So I was, you know, I thought, well, I don't know, maybe I'm losing the plot here, because I fully expected them to understand it, but they didn't.
It seems like you must just have to have tremendous faith in your own taste. You use the word taste, and it seems like, you know, you just have to have faith in that.
Well, I bet the same could be said about you if it comes to that, or anyone else.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what you really like, and you'll stand up for it, and possibly even argue with somebody about it. I'm no different to anyone else in that regard. I know what I like, and I get excited as far as music is concerned. It's very stimulating, particularly if you're there when it's going on in front of you. It's extraordinary when something really unusual is happening.
So you've crossed paths with the Beatles a few times, and you work on the Abbey Road sessions, and then you're asked to mix the Let It Be sessions after that sort of all falls apart. I mean, just what is it like being in the room with the Beatles? What's that like?
If I'm really honest, I don't know. It's no different to being in the room with anyone else, really. I mean, if you're working with somebody, all that fame and whatever else participate. You have respect for somebody because they're good at what they do, not because their name's Paul McCartney or whatever.
Well, it's hard to believe that Sean Buckley and the Breadcrumbs was the same day, you know, the same feeling as a band that you...
I wasn't necessarily referring to Sean Buckley and the Breadcrumbs, whoever they are. But, first of all, the amount of time I spent working with the Beatles was minuscule in comparison to anybody else. Yeah. One. Two, my work with them wasn't particularly successful even. So it was a thrill to be asked. It was a serious notch in my gun, as it were. And I enjoyed it enormously. And it was very interesting getting to know them. And what I discovered was just what I said. They're four guys, you know, who obviously weren't capable of being the same as the Milkmen, because they were who they were. Can't go anywhere, can't have an honest relationship with anybody, because everybody always treats them differently to anybody else, because they are, because of what they've achieved. However, in a working environment, that stops.
Well, they were a good band?
They were a fantastic band. The individual elements, just as in any band, were quite unusual and all had fabulous attributes.
So the 70s come and you're, you know, as busy as ever, you know, the Eagles and Who's Next and The Move and Graham Nash and Neil Young and The Faces and Paul McCartney solo stuff. You're just working and working and working, you know, until you do some work with The Clash. You do one of my favorite records, John Hyatt's Slow Turnin', and you finally sort of slow down in the 90s. Why?
Because I couldn't find anything I wanted to do. I struggled a bit in the 80s, to be honest. Everything was changing. The technology was changing. I didn't like that. There weren't really that many, in my view, at least I wasn't being offered great songwriters. I mean, my whole thing is I've always worked with really good songwriters, John Hart being a classic example. So I was finding it more and more difficult to find anything I wanted to do on the one hand. And on the other hand, I think the industry was looking for fresh blood to come up with new sound, you know. I think my sound was dated.
But it's such a classic sound. Well, yeah, but I guess I know what you mean.
Well, absolutely, and I think it happened quite early on. I mean, and that's quite understandable if you think about it. You know, I mean, it's things have to move on, and they do.
Things change, yeah. One of the biggest shocks in the book is that you have taken no drugs at all, zero. Which makes you really the only sober guy in the room, you know, oftentimes. I mean, you're working with some of the most famous party people ever. And I get the feeling that maybe the book is slightly the tip of the iceberg and you're being a little bit gentlemanly. And you do share some very over-the-top drug stories and things, but I can only imagine that it's the tip
they're
of the
iceberg. They're not to the detriment of anyone, do they? Is the
point. Yeah, they're fun, yes.
No. I certainly, the book is not salacious in any shape, way, or form, and it was certainly not what there's no malice in there at all, and there's actually very little need for it, and whatever malice existed is between me and whoever it was, and nobody else. So there you go.
So there's a lot of stories in the book that we don't have time for, but I want to name some people, and maybe you can just give us, you know, a 30-second or a one-minute commentary about them. Tell me about Don Arden.
Extremely unpleasant individual. Manager, had his own production company, had a deal with Decca Records, managed the Small Faces, amongst others, was a sort of small-time, well, he behaved like a small-time villain, used violence, used the threat of violence to get his own way. It was somewhat commonplace in the early 60s. When the industry, as we know it now, was quite young, and artists weren't protected in any way by lawyers and more reputable managers, there were a lot of rogues around who took advantage and made a substantial amount of money out of people, out of kids who were ignorant, and his parents were ignorant of the business, and they got taken advantage of, and Don Arden was one of those. That's him.
Tell me about Mick Jagger comes across as a guy who really is concerned more with, like, his the money, especially at the end of things. You know, just is trying to beat you down, sort of. Tell me about Mick Jagger.
Well, I think his business prowess. I mean, he went to London School of Economics. Don't forget. So, before he ever became a pop star, that's what his interest was, and that's remained. And in a way, I think the band have benefited enormously from that. To be honest, he's an extremely bright businessman, and has in many ways aided the band's huge success and the maintenance of it. I have a massive respect for him. I think he's quite an extraordinary guy. He was wonderful to work with, really professional to work with. I learned a lot from him, and I think he's amazing in many ways. Physically, I mean, how the hell at his age? He must be 70-ish, I guess. I don't know how old he is. A bit younger than me, I think. But for somebody of his age to go and perform in the way he still does, it's absolutely remarkable. I'm not sure that I particularly want to see it, but you've got to admire it. And if people pay money and have a good time when they go, well, why not?
Why not? You seem to really take a warm feeling for Joe Strummer.
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? Fantastic guy. Yeah. That was a huge shock to me because I'd hated punk music. With a passion, paid very little attention to it as a result, thought they were all morons and didn't want anything to do with it. I thought it was disgusting. And I was asked to mix the Clash album Combat Rock by the head of A&R at CBS in London. He was Steve Winwood's brother, Muff. And I have a lot of time for him. He's a really good guy. And he said, they've done this album, they've turned it in, it's really not right. Would you take a listen to it? Because I'd like you to remix it. So I thought, if he's ringing me, he knows me and my work. There must be something going on there. So I said, okay, send me the acetates of what they've done. So he did, and I listened to it. And it's the first time I'd ever listened to them even. And I was really impressed. I mean, it was very self-indulgent and far too long, and it needed some serious work. But there were elements of it that were far more musical, far more inventive, far more original, a huge sense of humor came across. And I thought, well, this sounds really interesting, so I'll meet them. And they came down to my house. Joe, and another guy called Cosmo Vinyl got out of the car and introduced himself as Cosmo Vinyl. And I thought, bloody hell, I'm in trouble. they all look like a bunch of mother rapers, you know. Really strict zips and things hanging off them. And weird shoes, and I don't know, very strange bunch of people. Anyway, within 10 minutes, they'd won me over. Once you had to go in conversation, particularly with Joe, incredibly bright young man, charming, polite, interesting. So I took the job, and Joe and I did it together, and we had an absolute blast. He was fantastic. He did everything, every suggestion I made, he was happy about. Enthusiastic, he encouraged me to come up with more stuff, so on and so forth. I got him to redo vocals on stuff, which he was happily did. He was just a joy. I mean, absolute joy. Brilliant guy. Huge loss to modern music, his death, I think.
Tell me about Keith Moon and John Bonham. You can split them apart or talk about them as a pair.
there's very little to compare other than the fact they made a lot of noise. John Bonham, astonishing technical drummer. Never heard anybody, I've never heard anybody's foot on a bass drum as amazing as his. The sound he got out of his kit was astonishing. He tuned his kit brilliantly. So he was the complete package and manna from heaven for me. A couple of mics on him and there it is. Just the hugest sound you've ever heard. Wonderful. Very nice man. That's John Bonham. Keith Moon. we'd need about a week, really. massive drum kit. Very little attention to tuning it so that it's musical in any way. He would tune the skin of each drum extremely taut, like a biscuit tin, just because the stick would bounce off it much more easily. He wasn't particularly concerned about the pitch of what he was doing. a very unconventional drummer in just about every respect. Well, everyone knows that, because if you listen to the records, you know that for yourself. If you listen to him on his own, you would have, it sounds like a wild elephant in a china shop, rather than a bull. It's mayhemic. But if you put the other instruments from the rhythm section, namely Pete Townsend and John Entwistle, in with him, it's quite extraordinary what he's doing. It's flamboyant. He'd never do the same thing twice. He found it quite difficult to remember arrangements, but that doesn't seem to matter terribly. I mean, you count Keith Moon off and see him at the end, you know. It was like letting a dog off a lead chasing a rabbit, you know. But extraordinary, a really interesting character to work with. Quite tricky on occasions, because he wasn't really sane, I think. I don't know. But a challenge, I'll say, both socially and to record. But it was a great challenge and hysterically funny guy. I mean, there are loads of, everybody knows all the stories. So, I mean, he was really funny. Some of them weren't so funny in the end, but because people got hurt and things. But there are other stories where there's no physical damage to anybody, which are quite extraordinary about him.
Shel Talmy, we've had him on the show before, American guy who went over and sort of bluffed his way into producing records in the UK, and you worked quite a bit with him in the early days.
Absolutely. I did almost everything he did for a long time. We became very close friends very quickly. A team, really. Yeah. Lovely guy. Really nice man. Considering I'm pretty sure he did bluff his way in, he got away with it. But he got away with it by being extraordinarily good at what he did, because almost everything he did was a hit. So, very talented guy.
Tell me about Andrew Oldham, working with him. What was he like?
Again, very amusing. He's an extraordinarily bright man. I think Andrew's skills were... I don't think Andrew was particularly musical, let's put it like that, but he was very good at playing the part and taking ideas from other people and manipulating them and using them himself, which is a skill in itself, I suppose. I didn't like him at all when I met him, but I worked with him a tremendous amount and learned to really like him a lot. And I've been in touch with him recently. To do with the book, in fact. I did speak to him on a couple of occasions because he helped me out with some facts that I'd forgotten. And he's as lovely as ever and as amusing as ever.
Does he live in South America or somewhere?
Yeah, he lives in Bogota.
Tell me about the Eagles, that experience.
Well, we need a lot more time than we've got now.
Is another book?
Well, no, I wouldn't dream. No, I wouldn't bore people to wouldn't know. No. The Eagles... a rather unusual combination of musicians, as I saw it initially, the first time I saw them. It took me a little while to get really what they were about. And when I did, I really got it. And they produced, as we all know, a really unusual sound, which hopefully I contributed to in some way. They made the most extraordinary... The key to them was their vocal sound, for me. And I've always been a big fan of harmony, having been in a church choir from such an early age. That's what got me interested in music in the first place. So I've always, the Beatles the same. There are lots of harmony bands that I've really appreciated. And the Eagles, the sound that those four guys created when they sang was just extraordinary. And the combination of those four is very interesting. All of the people I just mentioned, if you take the individual voices of each one of the Beatles or each one of the Eagles, they're entirely different. Entirely different. And yet the combination of those four voices creates this extraordinary sound, which is peculiar to them. And that in itself gives me a huge amount of pleasure to listen to.
Glenn Johns is our guest, and the new book is called Soundmen. You've got a book tour this afternoon. You'll be in Cleveland, Ohio at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and you've got some two appearances in Los Angeles and then in Nashville doing some readings, and there are links to that at your website, which is glennjohns.com, and information about the book and stuff like that. Tell me about the mechanics of writing a book. You mentioned that you sort of had to go in the attic and get the diaries down, and you had to call some folks and sort of clear up some things. I mean, how long did it take to do it? Was it a pleasant experience?
It was mostly a very pleasant experience, because it put me in touch, or made me get in touch with people I hadn't spoken to for a long time. And that was very pleasant, invariably. It was much harder work than I expected, but a challenge. And so it took me, well, over a year, pretty much solid. So it's a lot of work.
You've done the Ben Montench record that's come out this year, and you've done a Ryan Adams record recently. Are you working now on doing some in the studio?
No, I've been writing the bloody book, and now I'm promoting it. I haven't had time. No, I'm next year. I'm off again, mate. I'm back where I belong. Yeah, absolutely. Can't wait.
Is there a song that sums? A song that you just love that you've worked on in any capacity? Something that in your mind is the thing, you know?
No, there isn't. There are far too many. I don't mean to be awful, but that there really are far too many for any one album or any one artist or any one song or anything. There have been so many extraordinary experiences. I wouldn't want to seek one out, actually. I've been really lucky, man. I've had a really, really good time, and that's it, really.
You have just worked on. I mean, the number of records and the success that they've had is really mind-boggling.
It is, yeah. It's not something I've ever really paid much attention to until this, because it sort of obviously brought it to my attention. And as I said earlier, I've got no idea how the bloody hell I did it all, but there we are. I did, and. How lucky am I?
Yeah, well, it's all in the book, and I really, like I said, just a really fun book, really, for people.
I hope that the book is amusing. I set out to make it amusing, and I do hope that in some cases people find it so.
Well, I also, it just tells the history of the history of the world and how culture was shaped from, you know, the post-war boom until now. You know, all this music is such a part of that, I think.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right.
Well, Glyn Johns, it has been an absolute pleasure. I guess I'll have to pick a song since you can't narrow.
Well, yes.
Narrow. All of your children are too precious, but I understand. That's great.
Oh, I tell you what. I've just thought of a song that I did. No. Sorry. I would probably have needed advance notice of that question. Okay, I've just thought of a song.
Great.
That I do absolutely love, and I think it's quite extraordinary, and I it's on my one of my favorite albums, which is. The Rough Mix album, I think I made a bit mention of it earlier on. The Pete Townshend Ronnie Lane album, and it's a song called Street in the City with Pete Townshend and a 60-piece string section.
Right, there's a great story about recording this one in the book.
Yeah, there is indeed, so don't tell it, though. Let him buy the book.
Fair enough. Let's hear it now. Glyn Johns, thank you. It's been absolutely fascinating.
Well, it's my pleasure, too. Nice talking to you, mate. Bye-bye.
Very important paper. There's old Mac trying to busk with his new flute. Did you read about the Cambridge raper? Funny, it's just a game that they're playing. till they can claim their personal man. Gonna lean back on my wall and pray for the knickers to fall. See that woman with a bun in her hair? Don't she know that ain't still done anywhere? See that man going in the wig and pen? He was charged with telling lies again. I see the world go by as I lean against my wall. I watch as Fleet Street makes new heroes rise and fall. The news is written in the eyes of us all. One is a sinner, the next is a saint. Most of us worried about showing up late. I'm gonna lean back on my wall and pray for him to fall. Shame, who's to blame for the pain?